Morning, everybody.
Morning.
I seem exceptionally loud up here. No? Okay, maybe it's just me. Oh, man, don't y'all love pollen? It's the best, right? My goodness, this week has been a struggle. We're going to be in Revelation 12 for the next 2 weeks. Not a pool I wade in very often, so this has been a real learning experience. I mean, just to be honest with y'all, this message has changed like 4 times in the last 3 days because it's just a hard concept for me to get my head around, but that's why we do it, right? So we can grow, so we can learn, so we can deepen our faith. So today we're going to be in Revelation chapter 12. I'm going to read verses 7 through 11, and then we'll start talking about it. So let's do that. Revelation chapter 12, starting in verse 7. It says, "Now war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent, who was called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, 'Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death.'" All right, so when I started preparing this message, I really just wanted to look at verse 11. That was going to be the whole next 2 weeks was verse 11. But as I started reading the rest of chapter 12, it just made me realize I cannot just overlook this. This is just some good stuff, you know? And just to because it's something that's kind of, you know, just different and strange and very, just there's a lot of imagery and symbolism there. And it's easy for us to just kind of glance over that and get into stuff that we better understand, at least it is for me. I just felt like there's no way I can not do this. So that's what this message was really born out of. So verses 7 through 10, what I really love about them is they tell a story. And they don't just tell a story, but they tell it in this spectacular fashion, right? I mean, dragons and angels fighting throughout the cosmos. You know, looking back, it's like, why would I not talk about that, right? The visual here is just really off the charts. But, you know, the more I dug into it, the more I realized, as awesome as that is, just reading it, I think the reality of these events is even more mind-blowing. It's even more terrifying. So if it's okay, I want us to work through verses 7 through 10 this week, and next week we'll do verse 11. So we got war raging in heaven, which that alone just sounds weird, right? We think of heaven as this place of complete and perfect peace. So we kind of assume it's the absence of war and conflict. But that hasn't always been the case, apparently. Not until Michael and his army of righteous angels overpower the great dragon and throw him down to the earth along with his army of corrupt and wicked angels. That just blows my mind reading that. It makes me think how hilarious it is that folks who love stories and movies like The Lord of the Rings and The Chronicles of Narnia and stuff like that, they find the Bible boring. And it's amazing to me, really. But I guess the first question we could try to answer this morning is, who is Michael? Seems like a good place to start. Well, Michael is an archangel, which literally means chief messenger. He's an angel of the highest rank, the only angel given this title in the whole Bible. I would tell y'all I'm named after him, but I'm not. He's one of only two angels even named in Scripture, Gabriel being the other. Y'all remember Gabriel, right? He visited Mary and Joseph and Zechariah. Jewish tradition does name some more angels, but only these two made it into our sacred text. And we first see Michael mentioned by name in Daniel 10. In that chapter, the great prophet Daniel's having a vision. He's being visited by a divine being, by a messenger from Yahweh, who tells him, starting in verse 12, "Fear not, Daniel, For from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before your God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words. Can we just stop there? How awesome is that? Daniel has turned his face toward God and bent his heart toward his God, prayed to him, and because of his words and the condition of his heart, God sent a messenger to visit with him. That's amazing to me. That is so amazing to me. Okay, verse 13. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, but Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. For I was left there with the kings of Persia. So in Daniel 10, Michael's described as one of the chief princes or angels. The Bible's pretty clear in a lot of different places that angels do have some sort of hierarchy structure. Not really sure what that looks like, but it's there. And since there's a term like chief angel, it's probably safe to assume that some angels are in charge of other angels, right? That doesn't seem like a big leap. And verse 7 of Revelation 12 does say Michael and his angels. So he definitely has some higher level of authority than just your everyday rank and file divine being. He's a leader. He's a commander of God's angel armies. In verse 21 of Daniel 10, Daniel's visitor says, I will tell you what is inscribed in the book of truth. There is none who contends by my side against these except Michael, your prince. See, Michael's a warrior. He runs toward the battle, not away from it. And something else we know from Daniel's vision is that Michael is the guardian of Israel. He's their chief prince. Chapter 12, verse 1, speaking of events even further into the future, says, at that time shall arise Michael, the great prince, who has charge over your people. Now, I'm going to get into the weeds a little bit here, okay? I know some of y'all are thinking, we're already there. But I think this is important. Before Israel was a nation with borders, Israel was a people, right? They were a people who believed they were chosen by Yahweh, the God of the universe, to be His special people. Now, we don't see this unfolding in Scripture really until Genesis 12 with the calling of Abraham, okay? Because before Abraham's story, there's a very significant event that occurs in Genesis 11. It's the story of the Tower of Babel. Y'all remember Babel? I'm just going to read it. It's only a few verses. It says, now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and that B word for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. Okay, so God uses language to turn one people into many different people groups. Right? He does this so all these different groups would spread across the earth, they would settle in different regions, and they would have lots of babies. It's what He told them to do to start with, right? And what we see in Genesis 12 is kind of God starting over with Abraham to make Himself a new people out of this man's family. This is the story of the Jewish people we see in Scripture. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Jacob's sons, we get the tribes, we get Egypt, we get the conquest, we get the empire, all of it. All of it starts with Abraham. Now here come those weeds. As Israel, the nation, deals with occupations and exiles and these foreign powers coming in and ravaging their lands and stealing all their stuff and burning their temples down and all everything, It's like they come to an understanding that they are in real danger of losing their identity. There's a very real probability that they are going to lose their special heritage as God's chosen people, because they start to produce a ton of writings, y'all. It's a period of time known as the Second Temple period. It's a span of about 600 or so years between the time when the first Jewish temple was rebuilt. I guess that's where they get the name Second Temple. That we read about that in Nehemiah. And this period lasts until the Romans wiped out almost everything in 70 AD. So it predates Jesus' time on earth, and it continues on after His resurrection. This is the world of the New Testament writers. Now, Judaism as a thing really flourished in these years. It's a type of renaissance where the authority shifts from the Jewish kings, because there's not any, I guess, to the priests. And so early on, the priests and the scribes and the law keepers, they kind of spearhead this effort to reclaim this heritage that they're in danger of losing. This is where we get the stories about the Maccabees and the Book of Enoch and the writings we refer to as the Apocrypha. That all happened here. Y'all ever heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls? That's all Second Temple stuff. So it's an incredibly important time in Jewish history. Incredibly important. It can't be overstated. And the works it produced are invaluable to our understanding of the New Testament world and how the New Testament writers viewed that world. And also what their ancestors believed about themselves and their unique part in God's redemptive work. Now, did they all agree with each other? Of course not. We don't, right? But a lot of really smart people have pored over this literature, especially in the last 75 to 100 years, and there's a lot of harmony in a lot of areas. Customs and traditions that were passed down for centuries that really help explain how things came to be the way they are. And some of those ideas address exactly what we're looking at in Revelation 12 with these supernatural armies of good and bad angels. Now, I want to be careful here. Not all Second Temple period writings are created equal, okay? A lot of the Bible was written during this time. Almost all the New Testament was. But that doesn't mean everything written then shares the same authority as this, okay? Let's not make that mistake. It would grieve my heart if that's what y'all took from this. And since a lot of this was written during that time, and only a few, very few of them ended up in this book, that should really communicate to us how special this is, right? This is an anointed, sacred text. There's nothing on the same level as this. If it's not in the Bible, it should never be in the Bible. It doesn't belong there if it's not already there. So let's view these other works like we do a commentary, okay? I know y'all love commentaries. They help us understand the Bible better because they help us understand the world of the biblical writers better. But this book stands alone. Amen? No? Thank you. Thank you. Give a guy a heart attack. Now, back to Babel. Some modern scholars refer to what happened at Babel as the Great Divorce. I don't know if y'all have heard that term. It's when God divorces the nations of the world so He can devote Himself to this one family, to Abraham's family. And one of the traditions that we see, not only in the Second Temple literature, but even more ancient texts, is that when God does this, He places these other nations under the authority of other lesser divine beings. Like Michael was Israel's prince, other nations had princes also. But not all of these remained righteous like Michael. And Psalm 82, Psalm 89 seems to support this idea. Psalm 82, verse 1 says, God has taken His place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, He holds judgment. Verse 2, how long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? He goes on in verse 6 to say, you are gods, sons of the Most High, all of you. Nevertheless, like men, you shall die and fall like any prince. Now, I'm not saying this interpretation is 100% correct, but it fits the text. there's a lot of teaching out there on this particular subject that in no way is supported by the biblical text. This one actually is. There's an Old Testament scholar named Dr. Michael Heiser. Now, he's an academic. He's not a pastor. But he's written extensively about Second Temple Jewish literature and this whole supernatural interpretation of the Bible. He has a book called The Unseen Realm. And to me, it's a game changer. Max read it. If you get a chance to check that out, I definitely recommend it. It's a game changer for sure. But now back to Daniel. I feel like I'm jumping around all over the place. Daniel's visitor in chapter 10 mentions the prince of Persia in verse 13, okay, and the prince of Greece in verse 20. So these angels were apparently hostile toward God's people. Daniel's visitor says that Persia's prince even tried to stop him from coming to Daniel. So if we take that understanding of Daniel 10 and Psalm 82 and we lay it next to Revelation 12, at least for me, this starts to make a little more sense, what we're seeing here. A few dots get connected. We see that this cosmic conflict is nothing new. In fact, we could trace this all the way back to the garden. All the way back to the garden. And it continues to this day. There are battles taking place in the spiritual realms right now. Right now. Wars being waged between good and evil. And before these ideas ever made it into comic books or on movie screens, divine warriors like Michael, the archangel, who are loyal to Yahweh, have been doing battle against the ones who aren't. And when we join up with Jesus, we enter this fight. It's all connected. The Apostle Paul tells us that in Ephesians 6. He says that followers of Jesus have very real enemies, but those enemies are not people. They're the rulers, the authorities, the cosmic darkness and powers of evil in the spiritual realms. Evil, divine beings are our enemies, not lost and sinful humans. And sometimes I think it can be hard for us to see past the person who may be hostile to the way we believe and recognize the dark power that may be influencing them. I know it is for me. Because I'm just going to be honest here. This kind of stuff, it's hard for me to get my head around. I'm not wired that way. You know, you know people who are like very spiritual about everything? You know people like that? I'm not that person. And so to kind of see this bigger picture behind what's in front of me is really hard for me to do. So much of like, I dismiss a lot of what I read based on the culture of the time. You know, I'm kind of like a snob, I guess, because it's like you read about these ancient people and the way they looked at things and the way they thought about things and how it directed the way they live and the way they do things. And it's like say in Jesus' time, where you have like if say a little girl, her stomach hurts her really bad, and her mom's like, oh no, she must have a demon. You know, it's like everything got blamed on demons. It's saying, you know, that's just where my mind goes. And I try to find a more natural explanation for these supernatural things. And sometimes, a lot of times, there's just not one. Bad as I want there to be one to help it make sense in my little mind, it's not there. This stuff is bigger than us. It's beyond us. It's stuff that we can't understand. But ever since the garden, y'all, the natural and the supernatural have continued to connect. They've continued to cross over into each other's worlds. And that is just such a weird thing for me. I'm a very black and white kind of guy. And that's a shade of gray. It's just hard for me to get. But when I read texts like Revelation 12 and I really spend time trying to figure out what it's saying, that's what I'm learning. I don't even begin to understand what I think I know. There are things going around, things happening in this realm and other realms constantly. And I guess because we're so set in our ways and we have our little lives and the way we build our schedules and the way we insulate ourselves from the stuff around us, we don't even recognize it anymore. But getting back to, you know, what we're doing here, talking about these dark powers. I don't think, I don't think you have to be, I don't think someone has to actually be actively possessed by a dark power to be used by that dark power. Does that make sense? It could just be a little shifting of their feet, you know, a little turning of their mind. And it gets the job done. It accomplishes the task. And, you know, maybe some the people, and we can go to the other side of that too. You know, you got folks who they're not influenced by dark powers. Maybe they've just been taught bad theology, you know. Maybe they just have some strange beliefs about Jesus because that's what they learned. So there's two ends of that spectrum, and either way, neither one of those are our enemies. According to Paul, they're the ones Jesus wants us to try and reach. They're the ones that Jesus wants us to love and invest in. And when we engage non-believers with this gospel message, when we love on them and we invest our time to show them what Jesus really looks like, that's when we engage the enemy. When we're doing the work of Jesus. When we're telling people about Jesus and what He's done and what He will do. It's the word of our testimony, like verse 11 says. It's our weapon of war. It's what we use to fight against those dark powers. We're not trying to defeat non-believing humans, right? We're trying to rescue them and bring them to Jesus. We're freedom fighters. That's what we are. This planet is our theater, and we're in a war for people's souls. It's a real war, y'all. Now, this great battle in heaven where Satan, the original rebel in the garden, and the rebellious divine beings who follow him are defeated and they're cast down to earth. This is not a future event, okay? This happened with the coming of Messiah. If we back up a tick to verse 1 of chapter 12, we get the whole creepy context here. It says, "And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his head 7 diadems. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. She gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron, but her child was caught up to God and to his throne." So, two signs appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars. That's the first sign. Second sign, a great dragon with 7 heads, 10 horns, and 7 diadems, whatever that is. Y'all know what a diadem is? Have y'all ever heard that word outside of church circles? It's a jeweled headpiece, kind of like a crown, but doesn't have to be a crown. But it's some jeweled headpiece that symbolizes authority. And the dragon's got 7 of them. So this is a powerful entity we're talking about. Now, what we're seeing here is Mary, okay? This is the mother of Jesus, and she's in labor. She's giving birth to God's Messiah. Now, who likes astronomy? Y'all like astronomy? Okay, check this out. Can I have that next slide, Travis? Yeah. Can y'all see that? Okay. I got a laser pointer. This is getting serious. Now, what we got here, this is a constellation map from a specific date in the year 3 BC. Okay? That is the accepted year of Jesus' birth. 3 BC. This is from a particular date during that time. I got this map from SentinelApologetics.com. So, okay, right here, this is Virgo, okay? Her name means maiden. She's a young woman. And here we have, behind her is the sun. It's like her backdrop. So you could say she's clothed by the sun. That makes sense? Right here is the moon. It's at her feet. And it's hard to see on this image, but around her head are 12 stars. Now, they're not technically part of the constellation Virgo. They're kind of in the background, but they're there. They're always there. You can look that up if it doesn't make sense. Now, under her feet, right here, we've got Scorpius and we've got Libra. Now, fun fact, Scorpius and Libra used to be one constellation. The Romans actually separated them because there were 11 constellations. The Roman calendar has 12 months. They wanted one constellation for each month. So they separated Scorpius and Libra. So you put these two constellations together, and that constellation is huge. It's massive. And you know what the ancient cultures called it? The dragon. These are signs in the heavens. I'll tell you something else a little scary. The moon at her feet, you know, some constellation, there's an imaginary line right here. It's called the ecliptical. It's what astronomers use to track the path of the zodiac stars. You know, stars are like one of the very few things in the created order that are actually predictable and measurable, right? They follow certain cycles that are fixed. Well, this particular alignment lasted for several months that year. But the moon at the feet of Virgo lasted for 90 minutes. I want y'all to step back. God's command of the universe is terrifying. That he can take the natural world, the supernatural world, and blend them together seamlessly is just incredible. This is the power of God, okay? If you follow this interpretation, this is the power of God, that the signs in the heavens were signs in the heavens. In the night sky, which is what the ancients used to tell them all kind of things about the universe they lived in, right? There were a simple people who looked to the stars as divine beings because stars move. If you're alive, you move, right? That's one way you tell. These stars were constantly moving, so they looked at them as divine beings. And we have this sign in the heaven telling what is happening in the realms above the heavens. That's mind-boggling, y'all. That is just mind-boggling. God is so amazing. He's so powerful. It's just incredible to me. Just incredible. So what else do we got in this passage? We got this great dragon, okay? This is Satan. He's the enemy of God's people. He's lurking. He's waiting to destroy Mary's child. Now, Satan tried to kill Jesus when he was a baby, remember? They call it the slaughter of the innocents. It's when Herod the Great ordered the murder of all male children, 2 years old and younger, in and around Bethlehem. Y'all remember that? Well, Herod wasn't acting on his own. He was being influenced by the dark powers. And there may have been more attempts to kill Jesus throughout his childhood. We just don't know about them. The New Testament doesn't say. What the New Testament does say is that Satan tried to tempt Jesus and get him to abandon his mission, right? We read about that in Matthew 4 and Luke 4. But Jesus was faithful because Jesus is always faithful. And I can imagine when Jesus died, Satan and his loser dragon buddies, they all thought that they'd finally won, right? Messiah was dead. But John tells us in Revelation 12, her child was caught up to God and to his throne. That's his resurrection. And so Satan and his dragon buddies are all sitting around the dragon clubhouse. They're trying to figure out what happened. We had him. What went wrong? And who shows up? Michael. And this army of angels. And I love verse 8 where it says, there was no longer any place for them in heaven. Now, why is that? Because Satan is the accuser of God's people. Verse 10 tells us that, right? His name literally means adversary. But after Jesus defeats sin on the cross and he overcomes death through his resurrection, the accuser of God's people no longer has an audience with their God. Yes? Amen. There is no one standing before God accusing followers of Jesus. everything from a constellation map to the truth that the God of the universe has cast out all possibility of us being accused. We stand before Him free, innocent, cleared, perfect through Jesus. Like, y'all, come on. Come on. Everything is His. Everything. The natural world, the supernatural world, science, theology, everything's His. If you find truth anywhere in the world, it belongs to Him. He commands everything. This is incredible to me. This is incredible to me. Absolutely incredible. That God's people, the true believers, those who genuinely follow after Jesus, have conquered Satan by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony. That's verse 11. And that's what we'll do next week. But I'll be honest with you, verse 11 loses some juice without verses 7 through 10. That's amazing to me. It's absolutely amazing. Our God is so good. So let me pray, and then we will partake.